Well, it is good to be with you. Missed worshiping with you last Sunday, but it is good to be back. I'm thankful that I was able to go and help take care of things with my dad. But somewhere along the line, I came up with a really bad cold. And so I'm going to try hard to make it through the sermon this morning. Ed, are you ready to come read my notes if I forget? All right. And I'm also sitting down because I do want to walk away from the microphone, but I don't want to have the one on my face so that if I start coughing, I'm not blasting you all out of the room. So, you're welcome, Karen. One announcement I need to make this morning. We will not have Sunday school or worship, we will have worship, Sunday school or fellowship time on Easter Sunday. That's the last Sunday of March. So we will not be having Sunday school or fellowship that morning. So if you want coffee, you better bring your own. How many of you recognize the name William Tyndale? Yeah, William Tyndale was an Englishman who said he believed that every plowboy should have a copy of the scriptures in their own language. He believed that everybody should be able to read the Bible for themselves. And he was one of those who pushed very hard for the Bible to be translated, and continues to be his legacy that we continue to translate Bibles. But when he was trying to do that, he was living in England, and he tried to get the clergy of the church there to help him, and they didn't seem very high up on the project. And so he tried to get the Bishop of London to help him, and he soon realized that he was not going to succeed at printing the Bible in English in England. And so he went to the continent from England and stayed there for several years and did translate the New Testament into English and portions of the Old Testament. Well, William Tyndale's problem wasn't simply that he wanted to translate the Bible. It was that he continued to sit down with the clergy before he left England and point out to them where they were not living up to the call of scriptures. And they decided that they needed to rid themselves of William Tyndale. And so with the help of a foreign government in 1563, William Tyndale was first strangled and then burned at the stake. I'm not sure if they mean they almost killed him by strangling him and then burned him at the stake, or if they strangled him and then burned his body. But either way, he was killed in 1563 for the crime of publishing the Bible in English. What I find interesting is that there's a man named John Fox who wrote a book a couple centuries ago now called Fox's Book of Martyrs. And in that book, he recounts the stories of martyrs from the very first, with Stephen and James the Lesser, to Adoniram Judson, who is kind of the founder of the modern missionary movement. And though Judson didn't die particularly for his faith, he was imprisoned and treated very, very inhumanely for years while he was working in what is Myanmar today. John Fox isn't alone. There are several others who have written in the past years who've written about the faith of martyrs, but probably Fox is the most well-known. Another name for you. How many of you know the name Humphrey Monmouth? Okay, don't worry. You might know him as Humphrey Mummouth. I don't know. Don't worry, though. I didn't know of Humphrey until this last week, or actually a couple weeks ago. I was listening to a book as I was driving to Nebraska, and somewhere along the way, the author introduced me to Monmouth, to whom the author of the book I was reading referred to a different book, a book called Gospel Patron by John Reinhardt. And as I was listening and trying to remember things, I learned that Humphrey Monmouth was an important person for our faith today, though we've never heard of him. I looked back at the book I was listening to, and then I looked at Fox's Book of Martyrs, and they both tell the story briefly of Monmouth, and turns out Humphrey Monmouth was a alderman of the city of London and a very well-to-do textile trader. And before Tyndale left England, Monmouth housed Tyndale for a period of time, and then once he left and started printing Bibles on the continent, Humphrey Monmouth smuggled Bibles on his trading ships back into England. And it's believed that he probably helped to finance the publication of Tyndale's New Testament, for which, if you have a Bible in English on your phone or in your hands, or you see one in pews in front of you, we can be thankful to Humphrey Monmouth, though we've never heard of him. But also, Monmouth would spend at least a year in prison in the Tower of London because he helped Tyndale. This morning, we're going to be looking and thinking about Jesus and his trial from John chapter 18. We're going to begin with verse 19. It says, "Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. 'I have spoken openly to the world,' Jesus replied. 'I always taught in the synagogues or at the temple, where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said.' When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. 'Is this the way you answer the high priest?' he demanded. 'If I said something wrong,' Jesus replied, 'testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?'" And now skipping down to verse 29, because we looked at the middle part last, or 2 weeks ago, when we were talking about Peter's denial. Whoops, I'm not quite ready to skip down yet. "Then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest." Now I skip. "So Pilate came out to them and asked, 'What charges are you bringing against this man?' 'If he were not a criminal,' they replied, 'we would not have handed him over to you.' Pilate said, 'Take him yourself and judge him by your own law.' 'But we have no right to execute anyone,' the Jews objected. This happened so that the word Jesus had spoken, indicating the kind of death he was going to die, would be fulfilled." As I was thinking about this passage, I began to think about those who've gone before as martyrs, those around the world today who are suffering for their faith, and though we don't, this passage is the kind that encourages us and strengthens us so that if we must, we will be prepared. And we're going to begin at the end. We're going to look at the end of what John wrote in this passage and start there because, well, sometimes you just have to do things differently. So when we look at the beginning, John says that this happened, that the words Jesus had spoken indicating the kind of death he was going to die would be fulfilled. Now, you have to understand that John is writing this post-resurrection. He has seen what is going to transpire between this moment when these words are being played out and the end of the gospel that he's writing. And John is able to look back and he is able to see the things that Jesus had said. He's able to think about the things that Jesus has taught, and he comes to the conclusion that Jesus really did, on several occasions, predict not just his death, but the kind of death he was going to die. That Jesus said things like, "I will be betrayed into the hands of wicked men. I will be handed over to the Romans. I will be lifted up. I will die a painful death, and all of y'all will leave me." Whether it's in the Gospel of John or it's in the other three Gospels, we consistently come across Jesus' comments that he is going to die. Not just a death that is undesirable, but a death that was going to be beneficial for you and for me and for the disciples and for... and for all the Christians who have lived in the time between. But one of the things that we notice, if we look carefully at what John says, he says that Jesus predicted the kind of death he was going to die. Jesus was in control of his destiny. Jesus said elsewhere, he said, "I have the authority to lay down my life, and if I lay it down, to take it up again." Jesus wasn't being crucified simply because the Jewish officials were upset with what he was saying. Jesus wasn't crucified because the Jewish officials were able to convince Pilate that Jesus was at least dangerous enough that Pilate could lose his position if he didn't crucify. But Jesus was in control of his destiny. And God was allowing things to unfold in a particular fashion. So Jesus can predict his death. Jesus can predict Judas' betrayal. Jesus can predict Peter's denial. Jesus knows what's happening because God is allowing things to unfold in a certain manner. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't a second thought. It wasn't God said, "Well, they crucified Jesus, now what do I do?" No, Jesus was being crucified because it was the plan of God. It was the plan of the Trinity before Jesus came to earth that Jesus would die on the cross. And I was thinking about this, and I began to think and began to remember that if Jesus was correct about his death, then it means that we can trust him with our future. If Jesus was right when he told his disciples that "I am going to die by being crucified," and then he was, and if he promised them that he would rise again, and he did, when Jesus says that he can take care of us no matter what we face, do you believe him? We can give lip service to that. We can say, "Yeah, I believe that." But the question is when the chance arises, will we trust him? We can trust him with our future. We can trust him with our... we can trust him with our trials. Because there are several places where Jesus says that you will suffer. You will suffer for the faith. John 15:20, we looked at a few weeks ago. Remember the words I spoke to you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. Do you think that they persecuted Jesus? Well, I would say that they hanging him on the cross wasn't a day at the park. Or how about Hebrews chapter 4? The writer of Hebrews, beginning in verse 14, says, Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we possess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive the mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. The writer of Hebrews says, because Jesus suffered, when we face trials, we know that we can trust him because he's been there. He isn't just talking about things that come up and he kind of says, well, it might be this way. Jesus can say to us, yes, you will have troubles, but take care, I've overcome the world. There's a couple more that I would recommend you look at, and because of my voice, I'm going to skip several of them. But there are some passages there that all point to the fact that, one, we will suffer in this life, and two, we can trust Jesus because he's been there. So we begin at the end, and then we move to the second exchange. We're moving backwards through the story, and so we come to the second exchange in this story, and it is the exchange between Pilate and the religious leaders. Pilate and the religious leaders. They bring Jesus before Pilate, and they have decided what they are going to try to charge Jesus with. But when Pilate hears this, when Pilate begins to hear the things they're saying about Jesus, Pilate tries to recluse himself. Pilate tries to step out of the way, and he says, you know, you guys just take him and deal with him yourself. I'm not going to have anything to do with this. And I really believe that the reason is because Pilate understood the pettiness of the religious leaders. Pilate understood that there wasn't anything that Jesus was teaching. There wasn't anything that Jesus was doing. There weren't a group of people who were following Jesus who were doing things that would really, really mean he should get involved. And sometimes we look around the world and people are persecuted. And those that not are doing the persecution, but those that are the ones carrying out the work, they know. And there are times and there are places where where people are treated like Jesus. And that's what Jesus predicted, is it not? And so here is Jesus standing before Pilate, and it isn't Jesus yet that Pilate is speaking to, but he's speaking to the religious leaders, trying to delve into this disagreement. And he sees the pettiness, and he says, I want nothing to do with it. But here's the thing. The Jews are pretty honest. The Jews are pretty honest. They just want Jesus dead. They just want Jesus dead. That's why when Pilate says to them, "You take him and try him according to your law," their retort is, "But we can't put anyone to death. We don't have the right." And history tells us that that would be the case. That on rare instances, the local people were given the right to carry out punishment. But almost all of the time, it was the Roman leaders who were in charge of an area who were the ones who had the right of life and death. They withheld that from their subjects. And so the Jews, they don't have a good charge. They have really no charge against Jesus. But they want to put Jesus to death, and so they work through Pilate, and they nag Pilate, and they goad Pilate, and they end up getting Jesus crucified. And I think there's two reasons that they want Jesus dead at the hands of the Romans. One, they don't want to have to take the blame if a riot ensues. You know, they were careful not to arrest Jesus up to this point because they were afraid of a riot. And so they're afraid that a riot will break out and they will lose their position as leaders. The other reason is they want the Romans to have the blood on their hands. They didn't want to be ultimately responsible for the death of Jesus, so they took him to Pilate. And either way, I think that the spiritual leaders of Jesus' day, they wanted to come out smelling like roses, not fertilizer. Whatever transpired, whatever happened, they wanted to come out smelling like roses. They wanted to try to portray it as they had done something good for the nation of Israel. And lo and behold, even though they didn't realize what they were doing, they were doing just that. Something that was beneficial, not just for the Israelites of their day, but for the whole world. And we look around the world, and just as the religious leaders and Pilate are, in some sense, unjust in what they do, there are brothers and sisters in Christ who suffer under unjust governments. They suffer in different ways, in different places, at different times, but throughout history, one of the things that's been true is that people have suffered for their faith. And so now as we move backwards, we come to the first exchange. The first exchange, John says, they took him before the high priest, who identifies as Annas. Now, technically, Annas was not the high priest. Annas had been the high priest, and according to Jewish laws, he was alive, so he probably should still be the high priest. But one of the things the Roman government did, besides keeping execution to themselves, they also meddled in the local religion. And one of the ways they did this in Israel was they kind of put out the high priest job to the highest bidder. And they had since the time that they came in. And so you get a series of high priests that, well, some of them maybe shouldn't have been high priests because they didn't have the right family ties. But the ones who did, like Annas, they would be high priest for a while, but if the Roman governor or somebody else who was in control didn't like the high priest, we have record that they would simply depose them and put a new priest in his place. And so Annas is kind of like today. You see people interview one of our former presidents, and they generally start, "Mr. President, is the guy still president?" No, but he had the honor of the office, and he retains the honor of the title. And in the same way, Annas, well, maybe in a little different way, Annas was the high priest before, and he retained the title, the high priest. But we also know that Annas probably was kind of like a puppeteer. Because you look at the next five high priests after Annas, and four of them are his sons, and the other one is a son-in-law. Do you suppose that Annas had a little bit of power? So they bring Jesus before Annas, and John doesn't tell us much about the scene. They simply ask Jesus about his teaching and his disciples. What they're trying to do is twofold. One, they're trying to get Jesus to say something that would allow them to say he was getting ready to lead a rebellion. Because probably the easiest way for them to get the Roman government to do what they wanted was to charge him with leading a rebellion. The other thing that they were hoping that Jesus would do is that he would commit blasphemy. That he in some way would insinuate or say outright that he was God. And they would claim that that was blasphemy. And because of that, they would work to get Pilate to have Jesus executed. Problem is Jesus doesn't directly answer their questions. You read through the Gospels and you find that Jesus very rarely directly answered a question. Most of the time, he would simply ask another question. Sometimes he told stories. And in this time, he simply said, in short, "Where are the witnesses? Where are the witnesses? I went about preaching every day in the temple." And in the synagogues, "People have heard what I preached. People have heard what I taught. People know. So where are the witnesses?" And then they give the rejoinder. Is this any way to respond to the high priest? And they strike Jesus, and here's the thing, they're trying to intimidate him. They're trying to intimidate him to get him to stand down or to say what they want. And Jesus asks the question, "Have I said something wrong? Well, if not, then why are you mistreating me? And tell me what I've said wrong so that I know." And the thing is they cannot answer him. You know, there are a lot of things that we get looked at, talked about, have things said about us in the world that we live in. And we live in a world where this kind of thing happens and we just talk about it in different lights. And we don't see in our world, in our culture today, people dying for their faith. We don't see people being excluded because they believe in Jesus Christ here where we live. But you know, one of the things that I've seen in the last 5 years is that we live in this kind of culture. We call it a different name. We call it a cancel culture. Where if we hold to the truth of Scripture faithfully, and we believe that when God said whatever in the pages of Scripture that God meant what God said. From Genesis chapter 1 through the Gospels with the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus to the promise of Revelation. And when we stand up for these kinds of things, especially in the public square, but sometimes even in the larger church, we face the same kind of exclusion. And we see it around us all the time. People who lose their jobs. Not from something they said today, but something maybe they said years ago, taken out of context, and they're not given a fair trial. But when it comes to our faith, it's even more so. Because we're told today we should accept everybody else's faith, but we don't have the right to promote our own. We should be willing to listen to other people, but they don't have to listen to us. They should be able to try to convert us or force us into following them, but we don't have the right to ask. You see, we may not be facing death for our faith, but we do face trials for our faith. And one of the great things about this passage from John is it tells us that if we suffer for our faith, we can look to Jesus and we can know that he will be there for us because he has gone through it himself. I want to leave you with a challenge and a question this morning. John C. Lennox, whose book, Friend of God, The Inspiration of Abraham in an Age of Doubt, that I was listening to on my way to Nebraska, writes of an experience he has. He said, I vividly recall meeting a Siberian believer who had spent some years in the gulag for his faith in Christ. He was a short man and suddenly looked up at me and said, you couldn't face that sort of thing, could you? I was profoundly embarrassed and ashamed and stammered out no. He grinned and said, and neither could I. I discovered that the Lord only helped me to deal with such things at the time they happened, never before. I used to faint when I cut myself shaving, but in the camps I had to cope with what no one should ever have to endure. And the Lord provided every time. The question is the same as the one the Siberian asked Lennox, though I'll state it differently. Are you prepared to face suffering? And the challenge is to live your life knowing that you might be called to suffer for Christ, but that you can only endure with the help of the one who suffered before you and for you. Let's stand as we worship the one who suffered for us this morning.